I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. The Army-Navy game, one of the richest rivalries in American sports, comes back to Baltimore this weekend. The Black Knights meet the Midshipmen on Saturday at M&T Bank Stadium. It is the 115th Army-Navy game. In this hour of Midday, we're going to step back 50 years to a game that was played in Philadelphia in 1964. Army hadn't won the match in 6 years, and the Midshipmen were led by Heisman Trophy winner and future NFL Hall of Famer Roger Staubach. They were formidable. We'll tell you what happened in that game and what happened to some of the cadets who played in it, graduated from West Point, and went off to the war in Vietnam. That's after the news from NPR. Well, anchors away, and welcome to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. The 115th Army-Navy football game will be played Saturday at M&T Bank Stadium in Baltimore. Kickoff is 3 p.m. The Midshipmen from Navy have won the last 12 meetings of the rivals. Army last won in 2001. Navy had a streak of 6 wins in the early 1960s when the two teams met in Philadelphia for the 1964 game. 50 years ago, the Midshipmen were led by Heisman Trophy winner and future NFL Hall of Famer Roger Staubach. The story of that game and what became of some of the cadets who played in it is the subject of a new book by our guest this hour, journalist and Sarah Lawrence College professor Nicholas Mills. 1964. 1964 was the year of the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, a joint resolution of Congress that gave President Lyndon Johnson authorization, without a formal declaration of war by Congress, for the use of conventional military force in Southeast Asia in a place called Vietnam, and to do whatever the president believed necessary to defend South Vietnam from the communist North Vietnamese. The Johnson administration relied upon that resolution, the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, to begin its rapid escalation of U.S. military involvement in South Vietnam and open warfare between North Vietnam and the United States. By the time the war ended in the mid-1970s, it had exacted a huge human cost. Up to 3 million Vietnamese service members and civilians were killed, and more than 58,000 U.S. troops died in the conflict. The war tore the nation apart as millions of Americans came to oppose it, and President Johnson chose not to run for re-election in 1968 because of the growing opposition. 4 years earlier, in 1964, Vietnam was just starting to cast its shadow over West Point and Annapolis. In his new book, Nick Mills traces some of the seniors who played for Army in the 1964 game to their graduation, to Vietnam, and home. The book is called Every Man Is With You. The cadets who won the 1964 Army-Navy game, fought in Vietnam, and came home forever changed. Nick Mills, I want to welcome you to the Midday Show on WYPR.
Thanks. It's good to be with you.
Nick, that title brings us to a story behind this game, Every Army Man Is With You. It's taken from a telegram. Why don't you tell our listeners the story of the title?
Well, a telegram's a wonderful story. Dwight Eisenhower, the former president and, of course, a graduate of Army in 1915 and a member of the football team for a period, was a great West Point fan of football. And just before the game, he sent the team a telegram assuring them that every Army man is with you, talking about what it meant to play in the game, which he never got to play in because of injuries. So it was the perfect telegram for the players to get. Here was someone they respected. He was a national hero. He had just retired from the presidency and was living in Gettysburg. So it's the perfect meeting place, both of Army tradition and of a general, and of a link that West Point has always made between victory on the football field and finally victory in war.
And Eisenhower, former President Eisenhower by then, cared a lot about Army's football team. He thought they needed to step it up because they had been doing so poorly against Navy.
Yeah, very much like this year again. They had a 5-year losing streak to Navy. And Navy, of course, had this extraordinary quarterback, Roger Staubach, who would win the Heisman Trophy and push Navy to a number two rating in the entire country in 1963. So you had something quite different from now. Army and Navy were playing major football powers at that time. And they were small schools compared to, let's say, the Penn States or the Syracuse they played. But they more than held their own. So this was, in many ways, a golden age of Army and Navy football. And, of course, as you said in your intro, it was a period in which the Vietnam War is lurking, and I think no one at West Point or really in the country realizes how extraordinary that war is going to be or how long it's going to last.
Well, this leads me to, well, I have so many questions for you, Nick, but let's go to Vietnam just for a moment here. I mentioned the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. That was in August. Here it is, late November, Philadelphia, the game that you're focused on, 1964. When you spoke to these men now, you know, how in their, what, 60s and 70s, right?
70s, yeah.
About playing that game there, about being at West Point in 1964, were there conversations about Vietnam while they were cadets?
There were some, but as one player told to me, Vietnam at that point was still Indochina in a lot of their thinking. They had heard Kennedy had spoken there, and they had heard about sort of unconventional warfare, but I think none of the sophistication about what the war would be like or how long it would drag out or what the politics were, those really weren't there in 64. It's a relatively small American force. Remember, President Kennedy has just died the year before. So it's just the beginning of things. When the players arrived, which most of them got there in 67, 68, then the war is heated up, and it's a very different war from what they expect. And it's a very different war. They realize that the American tactics aren't working quite as what they're supposed to be. And they're aware that the war is probably going to drag on a lot longer than what's being said in the papers.
We're going to focus on the cadets in this hour of the show because that's the focus of Nicholas Mills' book. Nick Mills is a journalist and professor of American Studies at Sarah Lawrence College. And I'm curious about what got you to the topic of the 1964 Army-Navy game. Was it because of history, because of the timeline? It's in the middle as Vietnam is starting to brew. Was it that, or did someone suggest it to you?
Well, it's all of the above, actually. There was a superb piece by George Vesey, who's followed Army-Navy football for a long time, and it was about a reunion the team had with their coach, Paul Dietzel. Dietzel was in his 80s at the time, and they thought it was a good point just to thank him for what they appreciated. So he comes to West Point. He meets with the players. It's a very sentimental and moving occasion. But in the Vesey story, they also talk about Vietnam itself. The players really didn't they had a sense that things were going wrong, but of course, by that time, the Pentagon Papers had revealed that Johnson and McNamara, the president and his secretary of defense, had real doubts about Vietnam, but they were still sending troops there. And for the players, that was sort of the ultimate contradiction and really the sort of ultimate hypocrisy on the part of the government. So all that's going, and then if you think of the wonderful sports books that we've got going now, that is Laura Hildenbrand's Unvanquished, The Boys in the Boat, which is a Times bestseller. So we have one story about a track star who goes through the war. The Boys in the Boat is about the Seattle Olympic crew that wins the Olympics in 36, but then they also go off to World War II. So I think we're in an era where we're realizing sort of sports and politics and world history mix very much, and that we're also, I think, treating the players with much more respect than we've ever done before. These are not simply jocks. They're remarkably gifted athletes, but they're gifted athletes with great thoughts in mind, are able to weigh the moral and the political consequences of what they're doing. So they're remarkable men in the sense that they're national figures athletically in their 20s, and then two or three years later, while they're still in their 20s, they're faced with dealing a war that the country isn't prepared for.
You mentioned the Boys in the Boat and Unbroken. Boys in the Boat, we featured on Midday during this year. I think it's one of the better books that we had on featured on the show this year. So thanks for mentioning
that.
Yeah,
I think it's a remarkable book. I shouldn't probably be plugging somebody else's book, but I think all these books have the same sort of mixture of politics and war and history. And I think they're appealing because the players in them are so personally appealing in their stories. But then I think the stories let you get at larger issues, and they draw, at least I hope in my case, and I know in The Boys in the Boat, they draw an audience that goes way beyond sports. So that's, it seems to me, the interest and the really, it's the extra, so to speak, in the books.
So, Nick, we have a few minutes before our first break of this hour with you. Why don't we start by talking about that game a little bit, 1964. We can't fit it into 3 minutes, but we certainly can start. And I think we ought to start by mentioning how the 1963 game ended. We did a segment, an hour on that, a couple of years ago. Because that had a controversial finish, didn't it, the 63 game?
It had a very controversial finish. As you remember, that game was played a week later. The President Kennedy had been assassinated. The authorities at West Point and the Naval Academy were thinking of canceling the game. The Kennedys wanted it to be played, and so they did play it a week later. What happens at the very end of the game, it's a very close game, and you have the same two quarterbacks, Rollie Stitchway for Army and Roger Staubach for Navy, who will play in 64. In that game, Army comes very close to winning. They're on the two-yard line of Navy, and they don't get a timeout. And they need the timeout because fans have been pouring out on the field. The noise is unbelievable. The referee has given them the timeout at one point, but he doesn't give them a second timeout, and the game ends. It's a game in which the big story is the play that never got run.
Right. So that heightens things for 1964, the following year, where Navy is still the dominant team. The Navy is expected to win, and they're led by this great quarterback who later goes on to finish his Navy career and then go into the NFL playing for the Dallas Cowboys, Roger Staubach. That other quarterback you just mentioned, though, he was pretty good, Rollie Stitchway.
Yeah, I think if Rollie Stitchway had had a chance, he was scouted both by the Giants and by the Oakland Raiders, and I think if he had had a chance, he certainly would have been a very good. He was a natural halfback, really, even more than a quarterback. But I think would have had an NFL career, as would a number of the players on both teams. Staubach is the miracle man. You know, he's 27 as a rookie, and he has a 11-year National Football League career. The other guys were very, very good, but they were mortal. It's still amazing to me that Staubach could come into the league at such a late date and be so remarkable. But I think the other players really were pro caliber. They just never got that chance.
The Staubach story is kind of amazing, especially when you think of it today. Think of a very good college quarterback, a Heisman Trophy winner who takes off how many years? 5 years?
5 years.
5 years to finish his military service, and then come back into the NFL and be have a Hall of Fame career. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. It's amazing. The other great story is this, that Stitchway and Staubach have become terrific personal friends. They'll be at the game in Baltimore together. They do interviews together. They see each other all the time. When Stitchway was entered into the Army Hall of Fame, one of his presenters was Roger Staubach.
That's great.
So it's a really heartwarming story of players who, again, absolutely what they are like with each other has transcended football completely.
Nick Mills, we're going to take a little break here. As we do, I want to just mention to our listeners, we found a highlight reel in full color from 1964 of that game that we'll be talking about in this hour with Nick Mills, the Army-Navy game of 1964. Because Army or Navy, who's ever been promoting the game in Baltimore this weekend, has been tweeting out video excerpts from this great film. You can see all the highlights. Actually, there wasn't that much scoring in the game.
It's 11 to 8.
Don't give it away yet. I wasn't going to give it away. Anyway, it isn't already in the record books. but you can go there. I think you'll enjoy seeing this film. It's pretty remarkable, and it's in full color from 1964. So, Nick, we'll be right back to talk some more. Nick Mills, our guest. His book, Every Army Man Is With You, The Cadets Who Won the 1964... I guess the subtitle gives it away, doesn't it? The Cadets Who Won the 1964 Army-Navy Game, big upset, fought in Vietnam, and came home forever changed. We'll continue our conversation with Nick in a moment. But first, a brief reminder that Midday can only exist because of the support of WYPR members. Call 410-235-1395 to make a pledge, please. Nathan Sterner is here to tell you how to show your support. That's an Army fight song. The Army-Navy game, one of the richest rivalries in American sports, comes back to Baltimore this weekend. The Black Knights play the Midshipmen Saturday at M&T Bank Stadium. It is the 115th Army-Navy game. In this hour, we're going back 50 years to the game that was played in Philadelphia in 1964. So a small correction here. Actually, our guest Nick Mills corrected me in conversation in the previous segment. Army hadn't won in 6 years. They hadn't won in 5 years. Navy had won six of the previous contests before we get to 1964. So, Nick, let's talk about the game.
Sure.
I was watching this film. This film is really enjoyable, and there's a link to it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page if you want to see the highlights. Or one low light for Roger Staubach is early in the game. I think it's third down. Navy has the ball way back on their own 13-yard line, and Roger drops back to pass, and he drops back to pass, and he drops further back to pass, and the first score of the game is a safety. Do you want to describe that a little bit, Nick?
Well, it's a remarkable play. Staubach was a great runner as well as a great passer, and he was Army's third leading runner the year before, and he was their first leading runner the year before that. So he ran as well as any of the backs on the team, and he was very confident that he wasn't going to be caught in the backfield. Army was deeply aware of that, and they had all week long they had been practicing blitzes in which somebody on the second team would imitate Staubach, and he would be pursued. So on this play, they called an all-out blitz. The ball was on Navy's 13-yard line. Staubach thought he had plenty of time. And he didn't, and that really changed the course of the game in a lot of ways. They were able to nab him for a 2-0 lead, but most of all, what they were able to make it clear was that their defensive line was able to beat Navy's offensive line, and that would change the course of the game and really make the players confident in a way that they weren't sure of before the game. After all, they lost 5 years in a row, 2 years in a row to the same quarterback.
You mentioned the Army coach previously, Paul Dietzel. He made a decision about this game. He decided that there were going to be seven players. His seven best athletes on the Army football team were going to play both ways, offense and defense.
It was actually five of them. Then two of the others also ended up playing close to 60 minutes. And that's sort of something out of high school football in this age of specialization unheard of. And they didn't tire, and the players that were playing offense and defense included not only linemen, but they included the quarterback. So it wasn't as though it was just a few of the players or a few of the bigger players. It was players at the skilled position as well as linemen. And I think what that speaks to is both, one, it was a recognition that Navy simply had a deeper, better team in some ways. And second of all, what's really remarkable is we're in a period where nobody's weightlifting the way they are now. About 230, 240 is about the biggest a player gets. So you have athletes who are not sort of these lumbering 300-pounders that you have today. They were really terrific all-round athletes who could play football, but they could do other sports. To graduate from Army, you had to run 2 miles in 15 minutes. So these were guys who were just terrific athletes in good shape, and they all did do the the 60 minutes or 58, 59 minutes. Pretty remarkable performance that we just don't imagine anybody doing anymore.
And Rolly Stichway, the quarterback, played both ways in that game.
Yeah, he did. He was a very good defensive player. He'd come into Army in his first season as a sophomore. In fact, he had been a safety. Then he switched. Then he was a halfback, and then he switched to quarterback. He was really not only the best coordinated player on the team, but he was also the fastest. So he had a remarkable set of skills, and probably if he'd gone into the National Football League, he would have been a punt returner and a halfback and a flanker. Probably would not have played quarterback at all.
Nicholas Mills is our guest. Every Army Man Is With You is the title of his book about the 1964 Army-Navy game and about the cadets who went off to Vietnam. And I meant to ask you, had Las Vegas, had the bookmakers made Navy, I'm sure they made Navy a favorite in this game, but by how much? Do you know, Nick?
It was a slight favorite. Both teams in 1964 had tremendous injuries. The Army tailback, John Seymour, who's the brother of Paul and Jim, both All-Americans, had been injured for most of the year, and Navy had players injured too. And these were teams, in contrast to, let's say, an Ohio State or a Penn State, once you got beyond the top 12 or 13 players, they really did not have the kind of depth. Army at that time had a graduating class in the 580s, so they were really very, very small schools. They're a little bigger now, but they're still tiny schools, and so who you can get on the football team when you've got to fill out a whole class and you're playing a full load of sports is very different from a school that, let's say, has 5,000 or 6,000 students simply in an entering class.
Now, John Seymour plays a big role in the next score of the game, which puts Navy up 8-0. Seymour doesn't score, but he breaks away for a couple of big runs in this game, and then Stichway throws a pass to the tight end, another person you profile in the book, Sam Champy, right?
Yes, Champy is a remarkable story. He's an academic story. He finishes 10th in his class, which is stupendous given, you know, his football duties. He's so good that, in fact, Army sends him at its own expense to engineering school at Princeton. But he's a gigantic tight end, mostly a tight end who thinks of himself as primarily a blocker. And on the play in which he scores Army's first and only touchdown, the normal play on that is he goes out, fakes a pass, comes back, and blocks the end, and Stichway runs on it. Navy had scouted that play and was absolutely ready for it, and the point is they were too ready for it. They ignored Champy, who's all alone in the end zone, and says if he dropped the ball, he would have hopped a freighter. It's a short pass from Stichway, but it works really well.
Okay, now Army's up 8-0 on Navy, but they can't make it 10-0 or 9-0. There's no extra point. There's no conversion. What happened there, Nick?
The ball gets tipped slightly. The kicker who will later go on and finally will, in fact. Do kick the winning field goal, just has it tipped at that time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so they don't convert, but then Navy scores. Let's see, I don't know when this happened.
Navy scores right at the end of the first half. Army gets a couple penalties, holding penalties that give Navy second life, and then Staubach is just terrific, just impossible to really. Nobody thinks you can shut out Navy for a game, and he moves the team down, and they score on a running play after a combination of passes and runs. So, Army has played a far better game at this point. But when they go into the half, the score is 8-8, and of course Army is worried in the sense that they're playing the best football they possibly can, and all they've done at this point is get to a tie.
Mm-hmm.
So Staubach, all the players just enormously admire and respect Staubach on Army side, and he's terrifyingly good.
So I'm getting the sense that this game, because of the low scoring, this is a defensive battle, obviously. We get to what point in the game when the hero is Nickerson. I think that was the name we were looking for, right?
Nickerson. It's Barry Nickerson.
Barry Nickerson,
yes.
Is the kicker whose extra point was tipped, but who gets to kick a winning field goal.
Absolutely. He gets sort of his redemption, you might say. And that winning field goal comes again on another. Seymour has been opening up the game with runs again. And Stitchway decides it's another time to pass. He only throws three passes in the whole game that are complete. And on this one, he fades back. Champy goes far downfield, and he completes a 33-yard pass to him. And so that sets up the ball on Navy's 19-yard line. And then the series of runs bring them to the goal line. And rather than try to punch it over with a run, they settle for a field goal. And this time, Nickerson is good. And the story on Nickerson is he's also a remarkable athlete, a high jumper. But the following year, what happens to him in a practice of all things, he gets his leg broken when he's practicing a kick and an Army player runs into him. So his first and his only Army-Navy game is this game that he stars in as a sophomore. And it's a wonderful story. He's got the winning field goal, and it's his picture that appears in the New York Times and other papers. But he'll never go back and play football again. He will, interestingly, have a great track career as a high jumper, but football is simply too dangerous for him to ever risk it again.
Nick, we're going to take another break here. Before I do, there's one more thing I want to mention about the scoring in this game. I'll mention it real quickly. And if you get to see the film that I'm talking about, that's on YouTube of this game, you can find a link to it on my Facebook page. When Roger Staubach goes to throw the two-point conversion that would give Army 8 points, he's practically on his rear end. It's a remarkable play, and he gets the pass off, and it's caught in the end zone. That ties the score 8-8. But if you get a chance to see that, that's a pretty remarkable thing. Nick Mills is our guest. His book is Every Army Man Is With You, about the 1964 Army-Navy game. And then when we get back, we'll talk about what happened to the cadets who were seniors that year, graduated in 65, and then went off to Vietnam. We'll do that in just a moment. A quick break now as we urge you to make a year-end pledge to WYPR. It's easy to become a member. You can pledge online at wypr.org. Here's Midday senior producer Nikki Gamer to remind you why membership is so important. Fight on, Army. Army-Navy game Saturday at M&T Bank Stadium in Baltimore. If you got a ticket to that, you're a very lucky person. It's one of the great spectacles in sport, I think, is the Army-Navy game. I'm so glad it's back in Baltimore. And ahead of that game, we're having a conversation about an Army-Navy game from 50 years ago. Nicholas Mills, a journalist and professor of American Studies at Sarah Lawrence College, has written a book about that game and about the cadets, some of the cadets who played in it and their experiences in Vietnam and coming home from Vietnam. Members of the class of 65 who played in the 64 Army-Navy game. The book is called Every Army Man Is With You, the title taken from a telegram that the Army team received prior to the game with Navy from former President Dwight Eisenhower, a graduate of West Point. So, Nick, you know, I don't know if we'll have time to talk about all of the men that you profile in your book, John Seymour, Sam Champy, Peter Braun, John Johnson, Bill Zadel. But I think I'd start with a quarterback, Rolly Stitchway, since we've already talked about him as a player. Let's talk about him as a soldier. He went to Vietnam. He joined the 82nd Airborne, right, and went to Vietnam as an artillery spotter.
Yeah, he fought principally in the Highlands, virtually never got back to a base at all. He was really out doing tough duty the whole time there. The great story that Rolly tells is about his wife was pregnant when he left. They have their first baby while he's in service, and he finds out about it when a helicopter drops a note in a shoebox down to him, and that's how he finds out that he has a baby. And for him, it's both it was a great joy to know that his wife was okay, and at the same time, it's a very poignant story. It reminds him how far he is away from those he would love to be with.
Well, what did Rowley think about the war while he was in it and then looking back on it?
Well, while he was in it, Rowley talks about how he noticed that he and his group were going around so normally heavily equipped. That is, they could barely move through the jungle. They were so heavily loaded, while the enemy is really much lighter, much better prepared for movements. And he characterized it as not as you would a World War II battle where they're mass troops, but rather sort of as what we did as kids. He speaks of it as cowboys and Indians. And he really has a sense that we've failed to understand what the nature of the warfare is, and we fail to understand in many ways how determined a foe that we were dealing with.
You say in the book that he remains angry about political leadership during the Vietnam years, principally because it became obvious that American leaders knew we weren't going to win this war, that the strategy was not working, and yet we continued on even after the election of Richard Nixon, who had a secret plan to end the war in Vietnam. Thousands more died while he was in office.
Yeah, for Stitchway, that's really the great trespass. That is, he understands that people can simply, in good faith, be wrong about a war, about a strategy, about a lot of things. But once they've understood that they've made that mistake, to continue on asking men to die, that for him is the great crime. And he feels that that's simply a question of political cowardice, that's what really dispirits him. He's certainly upset that the military strategy isn't working, but his real focus is on what he thinks are the failures in Washington and at the highest level.
We'll go on to John Seymour now. Also interesting to speak with him all these years later about getting through West Point, saying, "I would not have graduated had it not been for the football team," and then going into service after that, and telling you that he felt West Point had not prepared him for the guerrilla warfare of Vietnam.
Yeah, John, just an acute and smart man who does actually his duty in Vietnam is in armored cavalry, which in essence is setting up the helicopters for swooping down in. His notion is that most of the lessons that he got at West Point were really carries over from World War II in Korea, and dealt with sort of mass formations and a kind of open warfare in which the enemy was visible and you clearly had markers as to which side you were on in terms of physically, that there was a front, so to speak. That really does upset him that the Army isn't ready for a kind of guerrilla warfare that he faced. He thought the armored cavalry did it very well, but he's astonished that their hit-and-run tactics aren't really widely adopted. So for him, again, Vietnam is not the experience that he expected it would be, and he, like Rowley Stitchway, once his period of required service is over, he leaves the Army, goes on to have a wonderful career in business, but does not become a career officer.
Sam Champy, we mentioned before, because he scored a touchdown in the 1964 game for Army. Interesting to reflect on him a little bit, because he did his service, am I right, he came out and then went to Princeton to get an engineering degree, and then decided, well, he felt a little guilty about not having been in combat, so he volunteered for Vietnam. Is that right?
That's right. Well, he would have, sooner or later, he would have had to go, but he speeds it up.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And that's exactly right. He feels he somehow, by having a soft life, by being at Princeton, which is a wonderful experience academically for him, and he also meets his wife while he's there, he just feels that he's not living up to his duties, both as a West Pointer and as a citizen soldier. So he wants to get to Vietnam, and he works very hard there. He works in an engineering unit that builds briefly until it's blown up, the longest bridge in Vietnam, and serves with great pride, although he too sees the war not being tactically fought as it should be, But I think he reflects what's part of all of the players, which is that they went to Vietnam, they weren't drafted, of course, they went to West Point, they were trained soldiers, this was what their career was, and they took at face value that this was going to be a right war, that America would win it all. So these were not reluctant warriors. When they change, and that's the remarkable thing, is they change because they're confronted with a very different reality than what they've been led to believe will happen. But they were very open-minded when they went to Vietnam.
Sam Champy came home. He ended up having his own business, right, in construction. And I note here that he donated and built the baseball stadium at West Point.
Well, he builds the baseball stadium at West Point, his outfit, and he also later does the Yogi Berra baseball stadium and the museum in Montclair. Champy is a New Jerseyite, but for him, both of those venues are sources of great pride, and he liked working all of the cadets, particularly those who went back and taught at West Point while they were finishing out their service. They have very warm feelings about West Point, and Sam has great feelings and great pride in the Yogi Berra Stadium, which is near where he lives today. And he liked meeting Yogi, and he liked meeting all the old Yankees. They would have been just slightly older than he, so when he grew up, of course, these were men that he'd seen play baseball.
Nick Mills, of the men that you interviewed, graduates of the class of 65, those who had played in the 64 Army-Navy game and went to Vietnam, how many of them expressed this thought that we've heard expressed by many over the years that, you know, the United States just didn't have the will to win in Vietnam, that if we had given it our all and put even more of our military effort into Vietnam, we could have won that war. If we had committed our full military strength to attacking North Vietnam, we could have had a different outcome. How many of them expressed that?
Well, several of them expressed that is, they feel that certainly if we had a more extensive campaign in the North, we had done more mining of the harbors, they feel that we could have had a more devastating effect. They understand, of course, politically why we didn't do it. But for their point of view, they're stuck in a war in which, as one of them said, it feels as though we're trying not to lose as opposed to trying to win. So they feel very trapped in that sense. That is, and if you want to use a sporting analogy, there's a sense that, on their part, that in many cases we're playing for a tie as opposed to a victory.
Mm. Can we talk about Eric Shinseki for a moment?
Yes.
In the time we have remaining, actually, because this really covers a lot of ground when we're talking about attitudes and views on the Vietnam War. Eric Shinseki, who was, we all know these years, as chair of the Army in the Bush administration, Veterans Administration secretary in the Obama administration, but he was a member of this class too, right? Class of 65.
One of the great members of the class, they all still respect him and keep very close to him. And the Shinseki story comes up in 2003. Shinseki, at that point, who was wounded twice in Vietnam, the second time so seriously that he lost his foot and part of his right leg and still stayed in the Army. Shinseki is appointed Army Chief of Staff, the highest office, something that MacArthur and Eisenhower and others have served. And while he's in office at the same time that the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, is getting ready to begin the war in Iraq. And Shinseki is testifying, and he's asked, how many troops will we need? And Shinseki gives a figure that's double that of what the Bush administration estimates. Shinseki's estimate isn't off the mark. It's the standard remark that you need roughly one soldier for every 50 civilians if you're going to occupy a country.
Hey, Nick, excuse me, I have to interrupt you. We're short of time, and I realize this is going to take longer than we have.
Okay.
I guess we just have to make the point that Shinseki was making the point that unlike Vietnam, you needed to make a fuller commitment and not risk the lives of men if you weren't willing to do that. Would you say that was the upshot?
That's it, and yeah. That's why the men really admire him. Shinseki did what Johnson and McNamara wouldn't do. He stuck his neck out. And he stuck his neck out early in order to save troops. And they really admire him for that.
Thank you, Nick. Nicholas Mills is the author of Every Army Man Is With You, The Cadets Who Won the 1964 Army-Navy Game, Fought in Vietnam, and Came Home Forever Changed. Roman and Littlefield is the publisher. Thank you, Nick Mills. There's another hour of midday yet to come, but before it starts, we hope you'll become a member of WYPR. Call 410-235-1395 to pledge. Here's Nathan Sterner to tell you more.